This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Spoilers! This is Geeks out on Joy 94.9.
Oh, Berlin.
Good evening. You are listening to Geeks Out, Joy's pop culture, sci-fi, fantasy, and horror show. I'm Miranda Sparks, sitting across from Clayton Wimshurst.
Good evening.
Oh, how are you today, sir?
Tired.
No, I hear that's going around.
Yeah.
Tis the season.
It is indeed.
For it. It's been a while since it's just been you and me.
It has. And, you know, I love it when it's just the two of us. I like all the other people too. Don't get me wrong, but
we just have a special vibe going.
We do.
On tonight's show, we break down the Golden Globes' lack of representation. A crisis is born in this year's CW Arrowverse crossover. And I talk all things Man of Steel and Clark Kent coming out of the closet. Gasp.
Not the phone booth.
Not the phone booth. He comes out of the phone booth. I love that. But first.
And now.
Geek News.
With Kids News Anchor.
Whoever.
Yes, whoever is sitting here in the chair this evening.
Hi, whoever.
Hi. Now, I've got some really interesting news for you, Clayton. This is a bit of comic book news right now. You might have heard the name Frank Miller in the past.
It's been penciled down somewhere, I'm sure.
Somewhere. Now, Frank Miller is no stranger to the controversy from his days penning Daredevil for Marvel to the blatantly anti-Islamic post-9/11 revenge tale, Holy Terror. For those who are comic book fans, that story lives in infamy as just, you know, a man who was completely gone off the rails.
I'm pulling a face right now. You can't see that. I did not know about this at all.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing that, you know, people will like, you know, wow, Frank Miller is cancelled because of this. And, you know, they would be justified in saying so. But still, Frank Miller's around and he's still producing work and it's still causing waves. Because Miller is at it again with the latest installment of the Dark Knight Returns universe, The Golden Child, with Raphael Grandpa and Jordy Belair. The story, which centers on protests against Gotham's mayor, who, by the way, is a bloated, orange-skinned tyrant who we couldn't understand. We couldn't possibly guess who that's alluding to.
Thinly veiled.
Very thinly veiled. I mean, that, you know, it's the thinnest veils when it comes to Frank Miller. It revolves around this orange-skinned fellow and an election tampering scandal with the help of the Joker and one of the DC New Gods, the jackboot-wearing Darkseid. The book also depicts counter-protesters against this orange-faced mayor as clown-masked fascists, which comes as a surprise to at least one reader, and I'm sure others, who remember that Frank Miller in the past made rather violent statements against the Occupy Wall Street movement. He's never exactly been protester-friendly, and now we seem to suddenly have this book that is pro-protesting Trump.
And can we be also pro-protesting Miller?
I mean, I don't think it's protesting Miller so much, because he's very much put the counter-protesters and, you know, the Gotham City government in this case as being very much the oppressors in this story, and that the protesters are actually, you know, the ones fighting for justice. Now, this is also interesting when you cite it with the fact that pre-release art of The Golden Child stirred controversy when a variant cover featured one of the main characters of the story, Batwoman, along with protesters fighting back against police using elements from that we've seen in pro-democracy Chinese protests.
So that would be the ones in Hong Kong?
That would be the ones in Hong Kong that are, you know, fighting against, you know, the Chinese government and the Chinese police and, you know, the, you know, Hong Kong police and the police state. And I know it's a real mess over there, but basically, you know, it sounds like Miller's come out in a really sort of pro-protest.
if they're protesting about things he wants them to protest about.
That might very well be the case, but, you know, like, the pro-democracy folks are very much, you know, no, Frank Miller, don't come on our side, please. And they seem to have had problems with being depicted on the side of Batwoman, even though it seems Frank Miller, you know, has his own ideas of supporting them.
He's clearly a complicated man.
He is a very complicated man. And again, this is a man who fields genuine controversy because, you know, I would say, you know, my own politics are, you know, like pretty much on side with him right now, you know, very much in a sort of, you know, pro-democracy, anti-orange-skinned tyrants.
I can't argue with that at all.
That would be my... but I sort of... He does have a bit of an inconsistent message. Maybe he's actually just out to try and troll everyone. Who can really say?
I cannot believe that he actually is still allowed to make comic books after making a blatantly anti-Islamic comic book.
I mean, it was originally meant to be a Batman book. This book, Holy Terror,
right?
But DC wouldn't publish it. Like the original idea was supposed to be Batman versus Al Qaeda.
Oh wow.
Which would, you know, that could have potentially been an interesting thing to explore if contextualized properly. But the way it actually came out was, you know, rather, you know, Islam is, you know, a religion of warlords, you know, who live in dirt hovels and, you know, want to destroy society and, you know, all of that. There was no nuance or, you know, even really reality to it whatsoever.
Yeah, okay, well, you stunned me. Yeah. I'm lost for words because I had no idea he did that.
Yeah, that's kind of why Frank, like, you know, some people... I think the word comic fans use when referring to Frank Miller these days is... Not really sure how to approach that one sometimes.
Yeah, he's the Sin City guy, isn't he?
Yeah, Sin City, he did the Spirit movie as well.
Right.
He did the original graphic novel for the film 300.
Right, yeah.
If you remember that also. He's been around. Plus, he was, you know, pretty much the godfather of, you know, reinventing Daredevil back in, I want to say, the late 70s, the early 80s. Characters like Elektra, Bullseye, they came around because of Frank Miller.
Interesting.
Yeah. Hmm. So, you know, he's definitely had an impact on the comics world and, you know, for a long time now. But let's change gears a little bit to something a little more positive. Now, I don't know if you know this, Clayton, but it's Keanu Reeves' world, and we're just living in it.
Fair.
Now, recently, he's left an impression on audiences in Toy Story 4, Always Be My Maybe, and his role in the upcoming video game Cyberpunk 2077. But 2021 may be the actor's biggest year yet, bringing us the fourth installments of blockbusters The Matrix and John Wick. And if that's not enough... Both films are set to drop on the same day, May 21.
Wow.
I mean, how wild is that? You know, like, two Reeves for the price of one, although you'll probably have to pay tickets to see both, but you have to decide which one you're going to go in and see first.
I wonder if any cinemas are just going to do, we're going to do a double bill.
I mean, that would be absolutely great. I haven't seen something like this since Guardians of the Galaxy and Fast and Furious 8, in which you had two films that starred Vin Diesel and Kurt Russell playing side by side at the same time. But I'd say this one is a step up from that. Now, can the cinematic world handle two Keanu Reeves blockbusters at the same time, or will one of them have to swerve to make room for the other? If that's not enough, we also have Bill and Ted Face the Music to look forward to August 20 of next year. The Keanu Reeves train is just rolling.
Well, there's definitely been a bit of a glitch in the Matrix for the 21st of May. They're going to be seeing double. Hey.
I'm seeing double. I see four Keanus. Now, if Keanu Reeves rules the world, then Disney has to come a close second, because according to Variety, Frozen 2 is the sixth film from the studio to cross the $1 billion revenue mark in 2019. The sixth, Clayton. That's like $6 billion.
Well done. Your math's sound.
Yes. My math is sound. I could be one of your, I could be one of your grade school students.
Yeah. One plus one is...
But, you know, six $1 billion films, like that.
Impressive.
That's an incredible feat. That's worldwide revenue. Other films from Disney include Captain Marvel, Avengers Endgame, Aladdin, Toy Story 4, and The Lion King. I didn't know Aladdin actually did that well. I know Lion King took us by surprise.
Mm. I found Aladdin not good, so I'm surprised it did that well.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people, you know, had, you know, like sentimentality for Aladdin, so maybe it was that real nostalgia value that, you know, brought the cash flow in. Now, there were two other movies as well that, you know, this feat is only matched by two other films not from Disney. The other two films that grossed $1 billion plus in 2019 were Sony's Spider-Man Far From Home, which still a Marvel film, but it's not part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
And a great film.
Yeah, and a great... In fact, I would say that's, you know, that's definitely in my top five of 2019.
Agreed.
And Warner Brothers' Joker, which is definitely not in my top five of 2019.
No, neither you or I loved it anywhere near as much as apparently the rest of the world did.
Apparently so. Moving into other news, we have something, you know, something a bit heavier right now. American Gods fans might be in shock to learn that this last weekend, supporting actor Orlando Jones, who played Ghanaian Spider God Anansi, a.k.a. Mr. Nancy, announced his being fired from the show on his Twitter account. He alluded to Season 3 showrunner Charles Egli in his tweet, insinuating that the show was shying away from racial politics. Quote, "He thinks Mr. Nancy's angry get shiz done is the wrong message for Black America." He didn't actually say shiz, by the way. That was me paraphrasing.
Well done.
That's right. The white man sits in that decision-making chair. I think, you know, it's pretty clear, you know, he's referring to, you know, someone high up, you know, saying, you know, don't be a coward, like, and actually address the race problem that's in America right now.
Well, I remember the first time that character kind of does a big speech about racism, the future of racism.
Yeah, it was
talking to slaves on
it was on a slave ship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was really powerful.
It was, and, you know, it's definitely a memorable piece of television, and to shy away from that and to bring the character away from that, I think, you know, for any audience is a massive injustice. So, you know, kudos to Jones for standing up there and making his feelings known. Jones went on to thank series creator Neil Gaiman and original showrunners Brian Fuller and Michael Green, but not production company Fremantle US, who we can only assume is behind this. Let's not call it a controversial, let's call it an unjust decision.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Very bad decision.
Now, in final news, this is controversial. I'll say this one is definitely controversial.
It's also a bit cute, to be honest.
It is. Everyone loves The Mandalorian's Baby Yoda, except it seems for Oscar Isaac, one of the stars of the upcoming Rise of Skywalker. Quote, "I'm not into the Baby Yoda thing," Isaac told news.com.au before adding with gusto, "Kill it, stamp it, smush it." Although, to be fair, Isaac made this statement when asked by a reporter who was cuter, Baby Yoda or BB-8. I'm actually on Team BB-8 on this one. Baby Yoda's adorable, but, you know, BB-8 makes noises.
My big question was, does it have to be an either-or situation? Can we not just enjoy both?
Oh, this is true. Let's cuddle both. I'm for that.
Yeah, I'll get them to cuddle each other.
Now, not much is known about Baby Yoda so far, other than it's apparently 50 years old and has force powers. I haven't been watching The Mandalorians.
I've only watched one episode.
We should really be watching. This is what we need Tamsin in for, honestly.
Yeah, my issue was that I don't understand.
Now, folks, when we come back, we're going to be talking the Golden Globe Awards, and it's predominantly white and male nominations, which, you know, are pretty overwhelming, you know, despite, you know, what may seem otherwise. We will be right back. You're listening to Geeks Out.
Hi, I'm Corin Nemec, and you are listening to Geeks Out on Joy.
Yes, folks, we are back after that very, very brief interlude. Thank you so much, Corin Nemec.
I love Corin Nemec.
Oh, I made sure to tell him so when when I went to meet him for that famous interview of ours.
I also just quickly want to say a very big thank you to Outtakes, because we forgot to do that at the top of the show.
Oh, we did. That was it's their 200th show, so that was a really big deal.
They don't look that old.
They don't look a day over 50.
That's right. And also thank you to Robert on the front desk before we forget to do that as well.
Absolutely. Now 200 shows, that's like, that's over 4 years nonstop, if that's, but I'm pretty sure they've taken a break.
I don't know, actually.
Yeah, it's worth looking into, but either way, log onto their podcast page and maybe check it out.
Nice work.
See all the work on there. And while you're at it, check out the Geeks Out podcasts, joy.org.au/geeksout.
Now podcasted by Tamsin.
And, you know, we hope Tamsin feels better soon. She was actually a bit under the weather this morning.
So. I hope she feels better too.
Absolutely. Now, Clayton, we're going to talk Golden Globes.
Golden, yes, indeed.
Big Golden Globes.
I'm sorry, I missed your joke, and it took me a second to catch up.
No, I wasn't actually making a joke. I just kind of said, big Golden Globes.
So you weren't talking about your Golden Globes or anything?
No.
Okay, good.
I'm not sure they got that golden, to be honest. But one of the things, you know, we've noticed is that, you know, while there is, you know, an increasing number of people of color who are appearing as nominees in the Golden Globe ceremony, it is still overwhelmingly white. Now, we did a brief count, or I did a brief count.
Yeah, you did a better count than me. I missed so many.
That there are 17 categories in which they give individual awards to actors, actresses, directors, screenwriters, etc. And of all of those categories, only 8 featured people of color. Now, each category has 5 nominees. All of them, except for one, had only one, only 8 out of the 17 featured one person of color nominee, with the exception of, let me check the list, Best Actress in a Motion Picture, Musical or Comedy, which was, which had Awkwafina and Ana de Armas from Knives Out. The complete list of nominees is as follows. I think it's worth reading out. Cynthia Erivo from Harriet for Best Actress in a Drama. Antonio Banderas, Pain and Glory, Best Actor in a Drama. Awkwafina for The Farewell, Best Actress in a Musical or Comedy. Ana de Armas for Knives Out, Musical or Comedy. Eddie Murphy, Dolomite Is My Name. That one looks really, really interesting, you know, because it has Eddie Murphy playing, I believe, Richard Roundtree?
Oh, okay.
I believe was the actor. I could be getting that wrong.
But you know, I never would have expected to see Eddie Murphy on a Best Actor list. But
yeah,
it's, you know, great that he's there.
But it's about the origins of a blaxploitation film, blaxploitation character called Dolomite, and how this, you know, you had this black pimp, almost heroic character, you know, who goes around and just sort of, you know, slaps people around. And
a pimp superhero.
Yeah, sort of like a pimp superhero, I guess you call it, like a street-based one, you know, sort of like Luke Cage with, you know, platforms.
Yeah.
But Eddie Murphy was nominated Best Actor in a Musical or Comedy. Jennifer Lopez for Hustlers, if JJ was here, he would go on and on about how much he loves that film, just so much representation from women of color in that movie, as well as just, you know, just an incredible cast.
It's taken up a lot of the chat on in our group this week.
It really has. Now, this is a fellow who, as well, has captured our attention in a big way. Bong Joon-ho, who has been... Bong Joon-ho, not who. that was a slip of the tongue there, folks. Who has racked up nominations for Best Director and Best Screenplay for his film Parasite. And we've talked about Parasite a little bit, even though it's not technically a sci-fi film. It's a family drama, if I recall.
It is a family drama. It has a little bit of a horror element to it, but not majorly. So
We also have Rami Malek, who you may know playing Freddie Mercury in the biopic Bohemian Rhapsody. He's actually swept up a Best Performance by an Actor in a Television Drama nomination for the show Mr. Robot. Plus, we also have Rami Youssef, who stars in a show called Rami. He has managed to sweep in the Best Performance by an Actor in a Television Musical or Comedy nomination. So congratulations to all of those brilliant actors, directors, writers for being recognized. And I just want to point out that, you know, when we say we want to see more people of color, we're not saying that, you know, we want more token representation or that, you know, we want more affirmative action representation. We want to acknowledge the actual talent that is actually out there that goes unrecognized.
It's been missed. My big thing that stands out to me here is that there is not a single nomination anywhere for the series When They See Us, which was so widely recognized as being such an important show for people of color. People speaking about how this is, you know, is almost as important as Roots, or was as important as Roots, and all this stuff. Yet, not a single nomination, where clearly that's something that should have been nominated.
I mean, does that go to say that, you know, this this kind of... this is... that the Golden Globes are the recognition of a white audience?
That is a very fair statement.
A very fair statement to say that, you know, these are the people of color who white people are recognizing on television and in media.
An issue with When They See Us was that it's a show about white people not being kind to people of color.
Yeah.
So that's why it's not a white people audience sort of thing. So
we kind of, you know, heard that before, you know, in Orlando Jones talking about, you know, his criticism of the season 3 producers of American Gods and his being let go because, you know, his very Mr. Nancy's hands-on Black America, you know, this is the message, this is my message to Black America approach, was not appreciated by white people in the annals of power. So, you know, it very much still could be, you know, that sort of thing going on. It also could be, you know, it's no less pervasive and it's no less insidious, even if it's innocent on their part, just about white people being oblivious and, you know, stuff falling under our notice because, you know, we don't think to check, you know, people of color talent first. We don't think to look in those pools. We generally wait for things to come to us.
Very true.
Yeah. And I definitely know that's something that I've been guilty of. And I'm still guilty of to this day, even though it takes a lot of effort to turn that around.
It does, because it's a psychological thing around what we're raised with. And I was raised in a predominantly white community, as almost everybody in Australia is. And so trying to change those ideas about being exposed to a whole lot of different cultures and things, which, you know, I'm getting better at as I get older because I've had more exposure. I live in a very diverse community in Footscray. And just seeing all those different voices and different faces just makes you more aware of looking around to actually see what's out there. And I think movies like Us is actually putting a lot more people of color into the forefront of our minds, and because it very much widespread appeal because of that horror element.
Absolutely. And I actually recommend, you know, actually searching out creators of color and, you know, of different experience to you in general. To find out what they have to say and realize and try and find a way to resonate with that and understand why that might resonate with a community different to yours, even if you don't personally understand it. Now, changing tack for a moment, another major group that often gets overlooked in these kinds of award ceremonies is women. They, you know, we make up 50% of the population. I was about to say they, but it turns out I am a woman. Gasp.
And it's actually 51% of the population, 51%, I believe.
Oh, there we go. I have been mansplained.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. But
no, it's okay. You're correct.
Yeah.
But, you know, we make up 51% of the population, and so much of what we see does not feature us at all. Now, How many years? There's only a handful of TV shows and films in which women are actually leading. I'm not going to mention the best actress categories because obviously those are all women.
Yeah.
Making up that category.
And I think pretty much all white women, with maybe a couple of exceptions.
With four or five exceptions.
Yeah.
But I don't know whether to count Marriage Story because it was Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson, I believe, like co-leading that one. Frozen 2, definitely women-led. The Farewell, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, the TV series Fleabag, The Marvelous Miss Maisel, Fosse Verdon, you know, it's about, you know, it has a male and female lead, so I guess they're sharing that one, and the Netflix's Unbelievable as well was, you know, about, was women-led. What I actually found strange in this is that the best television series drama category actually featured predominantly women-led shows. And for this, we have nominations for Big Little Lies, which I believe stars Nicole Kidman.
It does.
The Crown, Killing Eve, The Morning Show, and Succession. And while Succession is an ensemble cast, my understanding is that there is a good number of women in there as well. So it seems that, you know, chicks are really rocking the TV drama.
Yeah. And actually also Big Little Lies is written by an Australian female author.
Ah.
So the original books it's based on.
Ah, there we go. Mm-hmm. Well, so we're kind of rocking it there. But, you know, it is important to notice that, you know, on the kind of behind the scenes areas of production, that we don't see any women directors or screenwriters or, I don't know, what do you call the person who does the music score?
Music scorers.
We have no women composers.
That's the one.
Putting together the film or series scores for this. So, you know, we're happy to see, you know, a woman-led drama, a woman-led, you know, like, great female performances, but apparently, you know, we're still a bit short on women creators back there.
So there's two issues here. Is one is that women are generally given a lot less access to the ability to become creators.
Mm.
So therefore they're underrepresented going into it. Mm. And then you come in and you look at those works and they get, but this one's done by a man and it's good. And it's a weird contraption.
It's one of those things where I wonder, you know, if a woman wrote it and then put a man's name on it, you know, whether that would translate differently.
And that's, yeah, throughout history we've proven that that is exactly how things work. Yeah. If you want to sell, put a man's name on it. Not how it should work in any way.
I also want to put out very quickly that for all of her various talents, the late Carrie Fisher, who, you know, we absolutely adore here at Geeks, mm-hmm. and we're sure that you do too, outspoken, funny, brilliant woman that she was, one of her claims to fame was that she actually was a screenwriter,
mm.
and she actually wrote many a film comedy, and I'm pretty sure she racked up a few awards for it as well.
Postcards from the Edge is the one that comes to mind. I think that was, she wrote that, so
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she was an incredible talent, so whenever, yeah. I think oh, can women be a screenwriter, I just think to yourself, what would Carrie do?
Well, she would make awesome films.
She absolutely would. Folks, you're listening to Geeks Out. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be having a crisis here. Talking crisis on infinite Earths. We will be right back.
This here, Morty, is the Geeks Out planet in the Joy Dimension.
Gee, Rick, I don't know. That sounds pretty gay.
Yeah, everything is gay here. Ridiculously gay.
Oh my god, Rick, what's that?
Oh yeah, and there are those things.
Ah!
You're on Geeks Out, Joy, whatever. Wubble up, dub, dub!
Wubble up, dub, dub, everybody.
I need the new season Rick and Morty. Why can't I watch the new season Rick and Morty yet?
Why can't we watch this? Yeah, bring it out already. Folks, you are listening to Geeks Out and Joy 94.9. Clayton, you want to say something real quick?
I just quickly want to acknowledge in the last segment that we are certainly two white people who are talking about issues around people of color. If anyone is listening and would like to comment on that, we would love to hear that. 0427-JOY-949 on air at joy.org.au. Or you can call Robbie on the front desk, 1300... No number.
1300 Joy. That's 569-949. There we go. Although email's probably the best. On air at joy.org.au.
Absolutely.
Now, you know, it is very important to acknowledge that, you know, we're white people, so, you know, we're quite happy to take a back seat to people who actually these issues affect first and foremost.
Who can speak from experience, whereas we speak from seeing stuff.
Now, speaking of white culture, Crisis on Infinite Earths. I think it is a fair claim to say that the soapiness of a CW drama very much falls into the realm of white culture. We like to share it around.
We do.
You know, we like to invite our friends of all cultural backgrounds to indulge, but you know, it's that level of drama is peak white person.
It is, absolutely. And look, there is, CW is not too bad at having people of color representation. It could be better, but it's not as bad as some other shows.
So. But we definitely do have, you know, not many people of color, no people of color really representing the headlines.
True, so very true.
Because we have 5 DC shows, Supergirl, Batwoman, The Flash, Arrow, and Legends of Tomorrow. Although there is Black Lightning on Netflix.
Yeah, but he didn't get a main episode.
No, although I do want to say that Black Lightning, I believe that it was the show that Luke Cage wanted to be. So if you want to watch a really just, you know, cool show that really talks about, you know, serious issues, not issues that affect me personally, but, you know, I understand, you know, like very deeply affect black people in the US particularly, you know, check it out, because it's also just a good fun superhero romp.
Absolutely.
But Black Lightning actually did appear in this crossover as well. We've been having a lot of chatter, and I've been going on and on in Geeks Out News about this massive crossover event that they've been building up, because we've seen cameos in this. I'm going to go through some of them really quickly.
Just to talk about spoilers before you do that, we are going to spoil some things. We're going to keep as minimal as we can, but we don't feel like talking about the cameos is spoilers, because it's been well documented.
They've been talking cameos for a good long time now, so we're trying to keep it relatively spoiler-free as far as the plot goes. Mm-hmm. But as far as cameos go, we've seen Burt Ward from the 1966 Batman series, you know, like
yep. Batman. For all of 2.2 seconds.
We had Robert Wall from the first Tim Burton Batman film making a quick cameo.
Oh, I missed that one.
Yeah, that was right at the start. You know, he was just sitting on a park bench with a newspaper, and then his Earth was wiped out.
Right.
So, you know, in the very first episode, which I believe was Supergirl?
Supergirl came first, yes.
We saw the Birds of Prey from the Birds of Prey TV show.
Which I think, like, people are going, there was a Birds of Prey TV show?
Yeah. Which wasn't a very good show, because we had Barbara Gordon as Oracle there, you know, at the time. The character is currently not a paraplegic in the comics, but at the time she was. But they got a non-disabled actor to play her. And I've never seen a disabled character, a paralyzed character, jump up and stand up out of her chair so much as I have in that TV show.
Oh, my God.
So it was just terrible all around, as far as representation goes. We saw a quick cameo from the Titans series that is on Netflix at the moment.
Did we?
We did.
I missed that one, too.
Yeah. Now, here's the sad part about these cameos. The media leading up to this has been building up to the idea that we're going to see this massive crossover of all these heroes from all these different universes. But mostly what we see is a flash of these characters before their Earth is wiped out by this antimatter wave that's been, you know, that's going through the multiverse. So often these cameos are just, you know, quick flashes with no interaction with the main cast.
No pun intended.
I didn't even think of that.
That's what really has disappointed me, is that they've really, really hammered the fact, we've got this cameo, actually, no, we're not having that one anymore. That was Wonder Woman, sad. And it just was on and on about these cameos, and it's been so underwhelming.
Mm.
And I'm very disappointed in it.
Yeah, and there was talk of gathering together heroes from various realities to, you know, like, you know, the greatest champions, and they all come from either the Arrowverse or Earth-8, but there is one notable exception who is probably my favorite character in this entire saga, and that would have to be Brandon Routh coming back, putting on the tights again, playing the Man of Steel as the Kingdom Come version of Superman, who comes from he's a Superman from a tragic future in which the Joker attacked the Daily Planet and, you know, everybody died, and, you know, he's, you know, pretty much the sole survivor, but, you know, he still comes back and he's still hopeful, and he still stands there with his hands on his hips with his crisp blue eyes and that very gentle smile that only Superman can have.
Do you need a moment?
I do need a moment. Just, ooh. Brandon Routh, oh my God.
He's got the vapors.
She's got the vapors, folks. He was definitely my favorite part of this, because he's the person from another universe who actually gets to come and interact with characters.
Mm.
I was actually surprised to see Kevin Conroy as well, who was the voice of the animated Batman throughout the 90s and various Batman since. He's pretty much, you know, defined as the voice of Batman.
He'd be the most frequent Batman ever.
Probably. Mm. That's definitely a fair assessment. Mm. He actually took on the role of a live Bruce Wayne for the first time, and he's also wearing an exoskeleton. I thought it was the Kingdom Come version. I'll explain Kingdom Come in a moment, but it turns out that he was a different Bruce Wayne entirely, a much darker one.
Very dark.
Very dark. And we get to see him for all of one episode.
Mm. Just to point out, Brendan Routh is also a member of the Arrowverse in general. So I think that's why he got that quite extended role.
He was in the Rolodex.
Yeah. So he plays Ray Palmer, who is Atom. Mm. Is that right?
Yes.
Who's from DC's Legends of Tomorrow.
And it's very cool as well that they actually get to have Brandon Routh Superman and Brandon Routh Atom standing beside each other and being like, wow, the resemblance is uncanny.
Yeah, there's a great line, like, Ray, you're looking really jacked.
No, sorry, that's just me as Superman.
Mm-hmm.
What I didn't like about this, apart from the fact that, you know, a lot of these cameos were very, very brief, was the fact that I forgot how soapy some of these shows could get.
I know, it was.
And we're not just, no, we're not talking just cheesy. Like, it's always cheesy. No matter, you know, every episode you watch, you expect CW to be cheesy. But, you know, this crossover goes way past cheese and into soap. Like, it's just, it almost feels like drama for drama's sake. Half the time, characters standing around and navel-gazing about everybody around them dying instead of actually doing something.
Yeah.
Although, I gotta say, as someone who is a long-time comic book fan, this does seem true to form for a DC crossover. I read Zero Hour a while ago, and it was basically all the heroes team up to stand around and watch the world end, and then more heroes join in, and then more heroes join in, and then there's one punch-up, and then more heroes join in, and then the world ends. And that seems true to form, even though it's not very entertaining to watch.
Yeah. And the first episode of Supergirl was really, really soapy. Mm. It was just, it was trying to set things up, and it didn't do a particularly great job of it, I don't think.
Mm.
It was not particularly interesting the way they were setting it up.
No.
And then it was just like lots of soap between the characters, and then I think it got better with Batwoman.
Mm.
And I think it went downhill a little bit again in, which was the other one? The Flash.
Yes.
I think Batwoman was the highlight of the three episodes.
I would say so. I do feel that it was very, the plot was very haphazard. Like, it feels like it went some directions and then just sort of recanted almost very quickly. So in that way, some plot elements felt like filler. For example, when Lex Luthor gets his hands on the Book of Fate, and I won't spoil what he does with it, but that situation is resolved very, very quickly.
And very easily.
And very easily. And it just feels like more filler than it is anything. We do see the 1990s Flash in there as well. That was actually a good cameo as well.
Yeah, he actually is a regular appearance in the Flash TV series.
Yeah.
But this was really throwing back to that exact TV series. Like, he plays Barry's father and stuff in various episodes and we actually saw footage, that's a bit of a spoiler, but from that 90s TV show.
Yeah. That was also the scene where we also got Black Lightning actually joining the cast. You know, his Earth was destroyed, but it's probably going to come back in the last two episodes that are coming back in January of next year. But we actually do get to see the character of Black Lightning meet Barry, shake hands, have a conversation about their family, and actually interact, and I felt that was a very strong, warm moment in the show as well. any time in which you have two heroes meet up for the first time and shake hands, I feel is an iconic moment.
I do actually kind of like how the crossover between Arrow and Arrowverse characters is never animosity. It's actually all they actually really like each other, which I'm okay with. Like, I don't necessarily need my heroes to be at each other's throats or whatever else. So
it always seems to be the way of a traditional superhero crossover. When they first meet, they fight. That's customary in how they get to know each other. Another interesting comic book fact you might notice when you watch the show is that when something ominous happens, the sky turns red. That actually happens in that's actually a throwback to Golden Age comic books, you know, around the era of World War II, post World War II, early McCarthy era, 1950s. In comics, whenever two characters were going to cross and meet each other, and two worlds, whether figuratively or literally, were going to collide, there would always be a red sky.
So, but when worlds collide, said George Powell to his bride.
Yes. But, they would be like, hey, what's up with this red sky? And then would never address it again throughout the book. Just that, I think it signifies something ominous is going to happen.
Communism.
Communism is going to happen.
Yeah.
That's why it was in the McCarthy era.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm really hoping for a little more action when we bring back the next two episodes, because the last two episodes we have the Arrow episode and what's the other one? Legends of Tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I've been preparing for something a little more action-packed, because when we think big, ambitious crossovers, we think of something like Avengers Endgame.
Exactly.
Which is just a huge event. Superhero cinema has really spoiled us for something like this, which it kind of feels like it falls short a little bit as well.
Yeah. And even Marvel's television stuff from Netflix was very much not action-based. Mm. It was dialogue-based, which I wanted to see a lot more of, particularly Jessica Jones's powers.
Mm.
We didn't get enough of that, I never thought.
Now, I do have a prediction that comes out of this. It was very awkward in season 2 of Supergirl when they brought her over from CBS to the CW, that it had already been established that Supergirl and the Flash were on two different Earths. Flash on Earth 1, Supergirl on Earth 8. And they've just created a convenient doorway that they can cross over. But now that they're destroying Earths, I think much in the tradition of the Crisis on Infinite Earths comic books from 1986, in which they merged various multiple realities into one to make the canon less confusing, that they're going to bring Supergirl and her crew to Earth 1 so that they're all on the same planet and they don't have to keep planet jumping.
The only issue is that it actually makes sense for her to be on a different multiverse planet because it means that they're not going to run to each other's aid all the time.
Mm.
It's a little bit more tricky to come and visit and whatever else. So, but like, if all these bad things are happening to Barry, one, you just like give, hey, Kara, can you just like, fly over?
Sometimes they'll just be like, no, this is my city.
Mm-hmm. I've never got that, Barry has that feeling.
Yeah, I don't think Barry has that so much, but, Kara might be like, busy over here.
Yeah, just getting my nails done.
Either way, we're definitely going to be talking more about Crisis on Infinite Earths. If you love your cheese, if you love your soap, then check it out. I believe it's available on Foxtel right now, and some episodes you can purchase on iTunes.
Yes, but you can't purchase Batwoman. So that's going to get complicated.
Yes, it is. Folks, you're listening to Geeks Out. When we come back, we're going to be talking Superman. Stay tuned.
Because we haven't already.
Meanwhile, in the Geeks Out studio, a new superhero trailer has dropped.
Blogosphere is all over it. We need to get a review out, and fast.
This looks like a job for Geeks Out.
Geeks Out!
Geeks Out on Joy 94.9.
These are very short breaks.
They are. It's more of us, that's the important part.
It is. It's keeping us on our toes. Now, I just want to start off with something here, folks. Ooh. It's a little bit ominous. This is going to have a slow start.
Slow burn.
But you're probably going to recognize it in just a little bit anyway. It's going to be a very slow burn.
It's a yeah.
Now, this is actually John Williams' Superman theme, which you might remember from the old, I believe, 1978 Superman.
Christopher Reeve era. Which was the longest credits of all time. That opening credits, it just go forever.
Oh, they do so much. This is the extended version.
Oh, my God.
Well, we do have 12 minutes to fill. 12 minutes to talk about Superman. Now, Superman has been a bit of a thorn in the side of Warner Brothers for a while now. This is a character that they just don't know what to do with.
Can you read the title of your article here, please?
Now, here's the thing. Mm-hmm. I have taken some notes about what is half a rant, half a discussion. How do you solve a problem like Superman?
That's cute. I like that.
That sounds like something... That sounds like something a very nice Lex Luthor would say. But in all earnestness, there have been rumors recently published in Variety about another Superman reboot, which would be starring Michael B. Jordan, which I would actually totally be behind to see.
I'm happy to see Michael B. Jordan in anything.
I mean, this is true. Now, while I am a Superman snob and, you know, insist that any white actor who plays Superman needs blue eyes, I love Tyler Hoechlin, but, you know, like, His Superman needs blue contact lenses right now.
Stat.
You know, in fact, even Michael B. Jordan would need blue contact lenses. Superman needs the blue eyes.
Interesting.
I mean, there are black people with blue eyes and green eyes.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking also he's from a different planet, so we can kind of just do what we want anyway.
I mean, it's true. But, oh, the Superman theme is so quiet. But then it's building up.
Yes.
But they're talking about Michael B. Jordan possibly in a reboot and possibly J.J. Abrams at the helm, which, you know, mixed feelings about it. It feels like they're going to J.J. Abrams for everything at the moment.
Hey, J.J., can you fix this for us? Thanks.
Now, Forbes contributor Danny DePlacido has come out with an article, DC Films Still Doesn't Know What to Do with Superman. And from that, it spurred a massive online discussion among fans about what to do with the Man of Steel. It said that truth, justice, and the American way don't resonate with audiences, and that Superman isn't cool. And I ask you, was he ever cool? But those key aspects of Superman haven't really been embraced since the Christopher Reeve era. We've had two Superman reboots in the last 20 years, including Superman Returns, starring Brandon Routh,
mm-hmm.
who we talked about before. That didn't do very well.
That was a bit of a bomb.
We also had Henry Cavill coming in with Man of Steel, which also didn't quite take home nearly as much as DC hoped it would. And DC Films haven't been doing too great either. You know, like Wonder Woman, Shazam, and Wonder Woman have had moderate success, but Suicide Squad and Justice League.
You said Wonder Woman twice there, so Aquaman is what
Aquaman.
You meant.
Yeah, yeah. Wonder Woman, Shazam, and Aquaman is what
yeah.
I meant. But Suicide Squad and Justice League have been critically panned, not to mention the laughably inadequate Superman v. Batman Dawn of Justice. Martha is now a meme.
We reference Martha all the time here at Geeks Out.
We do reference Martha quite a bit. Oh, here we go. Here's the fanfare.
Oh, well, finally, we got there. I'd also like to point out that they were just badly written movies.
They really were, which is a shame. They deserve so much better and, like, an earnest approach. And, you know, as much as people love Zack Snyder and that they want to see a Snyder cut of Justice League, I'm honestly, you know, at a loss as to why anyone would want such a dark film to begin with, especially when the Justice League or even Superman doesn't represent that. Now, it's not that Superman can't sell. We've seen Superman in various properties, mostly Justice League properties and animated series. You know, like, kids love him.
Yeah.
They definitely do. And, you know, the older fans, you know, will actually go and watch kids' cartoons. I may be one of those fans. You know, he had his own animated series following Batman, the animated series. We've seen him live action in Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman. We've seen Clark Kent do well in, you know, Smallville, had a very fanatical following. Plus, we have fans in the new Supergirl series, which does, you know, extend from the Superman mythos. If these things can do well, why isn't he doing well on film? Honestly, you know, my personal belief here, and, you know, feel free to chime in, mm-hmm. is that they haven't approached the character and made him the big dork that he actually is. Superman's supposed to be the guy that flies in, and, you know, even though, you know, he has, quote-unquote, the powers of a god, you know, he's still someone who lets people be people, and he's someone who is, you know, very forgiving and understanding of human nature.
And he's still Smallville.
Yeah. And he believes in the best of us, you know, and, you know, we're the best of our capabilities, you know, and he doesn't treat us like ants. That's what Superman is, and I don't think the creators that they've given him to, for the most part, have really respected or understood that aspect of him.
I'm going to make a statement that's kind of moving into a question. So,
go on.
So we're talking about the truth, justice, and the American way. Superman needs to be more a global hero. Mm. How much have the comic books moved from that American concept into a global concept?
I would say the comics have largely moved into a global concept, but I believe when they talk about the American way, it very much embodies it much in the same way that Captain America does. If you'd have asked me 10 years ago, would Captain America have been a hero that really grokked onto the social schema and really connected with audiences the world over, even though America is in his name, he's literally wearing the stars and stripes, I would have said it couldn't happen.
Mm.
But when we talk about what Captain America stands for, it is an American ideal at its best, at its height, you know, actually fighting a proper evil, you know, like, you know, the Nazis and the Axis powers. We're talking about, you know, America that actually believes in, you know, itself and each other and its ingenuity and, you know, and is kind and, you know, lends a helping hand. It's talking about, you know, farm boy sort of people, you know, who are glad to pull over on the side of the road and help you out. And that's when they talk about the American way with Superman, that's how I relate it back. I kind of think of it in the same way as Captain America. So while they're moving away from the idea of, you know, the exclusively an American way, that's the kind of thing that I imagine they're talking about.
But even Wonder Woman, who is not an American, she is
Thanissarian. She wears the colors.
Yeah. But she gets around in American colors. That's exactly what I was going to say. Mm. So it's, you know, at that time, it made sense, but it doesn't really make sense, which I guess is what they've gone with in the newer costume for Wonder Woman and Wonder Woman 1984. They've come away from those American flag colors and into something a little more shiny and new.
Yeah, definitely. It's so weird. Like, it's a very retro idea of Americana, of a more innocent America, which it definitely is not today. If we were talking about the modern American way, it would be a lot more jaded. And they have explored that in some comic book stories, not so much in film, about, you know, what believing in modern day America compared to, say, what World War II America would be. Mm. I'm pretty sure, you know, a lot of my attitudes toward America would be a lot more positive if I were living in that time when America was actually being a savior instead of an invader. But back to the conversation, you know, how do you make Superman relevant? There actually is one take which I'm very much on board with, and that is the take of comic scribe Brian Michael Bendis, who I have become a rather huge fan. Well, I've been a fan of him for a while, ever since he was doing Ultimate Spider-Man and Daredevil for Marvel. His take in this month's Superman issue 18 saw the Man of Steel coming forward and announcing the details of his dual identity to the world in a press conference, that he is both Clark Kent and Superman in the DC universe is now public knowledge.
Agreed. That I think it's always annoyed me that characters have to have these dual identities. It's just such a tired trope.
Well, you know, it was kind of, you know, a thing, you know, like to protect my loved ones.
Yeah.
Was the idea, which, you know, I think is, you know, not entirely unfair. Mm. And, you know, you can kind of understand that, but, you know, like it is, you know, a classic trope. This isn't the first time Superman's identity has been made public in DC Comics. His dual identity was public knowledge a few years ago during the now-retconned New 52 series when a jilted Lois Lane outed him on the front page of the Daily Planet. This less-than-optimistic change failed to grab fans as it did during this new piece when he came out by choice. And fans of this series, while some were skeptical at first, have responded positively to this development. Perhaps feeling that an open, emotionally vulnerable Superman, proud of all aspects of his heritage, is what the modern age represents best in all of us.
Did he have a coming out party?
I don't know if he's had the coming out party. Like, they've just had the moment where he did the official coming out. There was even a beautiful scene where, you know, Clark, before he came out, he went up to Perry White. He just, you know, is like, Perry, I need to talk to you. Shows him that he's Superman. And then they have a hug. And they're just, like, oh, I had a feeling.
I feel like there could be a gay porn version of that where, you know, because then they make out and, you know, goes from there.
Oh, Clayton, you just had to take it there.
I did. I'm sorry.
But it was actually a really beautiful story because this is a Superman that came out and said, no, I'm not Superman who's been pretending to be human. I'm not just Superman. I am Clark Kent. I also like being a reporter and I plan to continue being a reporter. But keeping these two parts of my life separate felt like I was being dishonest. And there definitely is, I feel, a push in the cultural schema right now toward radical honesty and embracing of all aspects of yourself and being more loud and proud and individual. And so I think this is the move forward that Superman needs. And I'm just like saying, DC Studios, if you need a hint, just look to the people who are already writing for you.
Get him to come out of the phone booth.
Folks, you are listening to Geeks Out. We'll be right back to say our goodbyes.
You're listening to Geeks Out on Joy 94.9. For more, head to joy.org.au/geeksout to sink your teeth into our podcasts. Like us on Facebook at Geeks Out Joy 949 and follow us on Twitter at Geeks Out Joy 949.
And do check out our podcast and socials. And thank you so much to Tamsin as well, who has taken over podcasting duties and will be bringing you the very latest as soon as she can get her hot little hands on the keys.
I passed the torch to Miranda. Miranda passed it to Tamsin.
And the cycle continues.
That's right.
It's the circle of life. It's the end of the show, Clayton.
It is.
It is the end of the show, and we're going to pass on our own torch tonight to Jordan on Homophonics right up next. But before we go, another Superman theme for you. This is Hans Zimmer, Flight from Man of Steel. You have been listening to Joy 94.9, Geeks Out. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
To a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.